Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Values in a secular culture. That's a very broad subject, and when I was asked about this, I thought this is actually an impossible subject in terms of doing evangelism in secular culture. Means the culture is secular, but then all the individuals, they are individuals, and they are so different. So it's you cannot find one method or one way that is really helpful for everyone, because the individuals will have their they will be thinkers, or they will be more of feelers and value experiences. They will be, some of them really, what do you say in English, happy-go-lucky, or not bothered with much of life, and others will be people that are deeply hurt. Some people will have no experience of the Christian church, others will have like a lot of experience of some kind of Christianity. So the variety is enormous, and how on earth do evangelism in this kind of pluralistic society? So I will not give you the method to do it. I will actually let your network here end with a Bible study from the Book of Acts, and where I will draw some conclusions that I think or hope can help us when dealing then with how should I develop evangelism in my context, in my culture. Let me begin with this quote from Evelyn Waugh. Is that the right pronunciation? It's an old quote. It's from the 1930s. He is the writer of Brideshead Revisited, which is a famous novel in English, and it's very well known through several movies that have been, which is based on this novel. Anyhow, Evelyn Waugh, he said back in the 1930s this, and I think it's an interesting quote. Just let me add, because he says something here about Protestantism and Roman Catholicism. I just come from a panel with Leonardo on assessing Roman Catholic theologies, and misread this quote, or why I'm quoting this here. Okay, he says, "It seems to me that in the present phase of European history, the essential issue is no longer between Catholicism on one side and Protestantism on the other, but between Christianity and chaos. Civilization, and by this I do not mean talking cinemas," this is an early quote, "I do not mean talking cinemas and tinned food, nor even surgery and hygiene houses, but the whole moral and artistic organization of Europe, has not in itself the power of survival. It came into being through Christianity, and without it has no significance of power to command allegiance." So he's connecting the whole European civilization with Christianity. Now my point here is not to say that the Christian faith is about building civilization. The Christian faith is about connecting created human beings to the Creator through the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's the point of the Christian faith. But being connected to your Creator then has so many consequences, which is behind the whole civilization. And I take this quote as my starting point, because one of my main points today will be that we, in our evangelists, need to have a big picture perspective. And this is part of the big picture perspective. invite you to turn to a text in the Book of Acts, which is not very well known, I think, not least in my context, and that is Acts chapter 14, and Paul's visit in Lystra. It's a strange, fascinating series of events happening there. You can discuss if Paul was really successful in his preaching. What happened was that he was almost killed. He was almost stoned to death afterwards. But there are people coming to faith. In the end of the story, there are some disciples helping him after he's been stoned. But let's read it and see what Paul did and said in Lystra and what we can learn from that. So Paul fled from Thessalonica and came down to Lystra, and it says in Acts chapter 14 from verse 8. In Lystra there sat a man who was lame. He had been that way from birth and had never walked. He listened to Paul as he was speaking. Paul looked directly at him, saw that he had faith to be healed, and called out, "Stand up on your feet." At that, the man jumped up and began to walk. When the crowd saw what Paul had done, they shouted in the Lycaonian language, "The gods have come down to us in human form." Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul they called Hermas, because he was the chief speaker. The priest of Zeus, whose temple was just outside the city, brought boughs and reeds to the city gates, because he and the crowd wanted to offer sacrifices to them. But when the apostles, Barnabas and Paul, heard of this, they tore their clothes and rushed into the crowd, shouting. I think I stop here, just to make some comments before we move into the message of Paul. I find this a very fascinating story. So, Paul is preaching, and he realizes that God wants to heal this man who has been crippled since birth. And the man is instantly healed. And that is causing an enormous sensation in the city. And the people starts to shout about two gods that have visited the city. And the situation seems to be that Paul and Barnabas do not really realize what's going on. Luke is emphasizing the people are shouting in the Lycaonian language, which they, of course, do not speak. And my guess is that they are focused on the man who has been healed, trying to explain for him the gospel, who has healed him, and what it now is calling, what this means for this man, that he should now start to follow Jesus. So they are not fully aware of all the chaos. And it seems it's like first when the priest of the Zeus temple, which was outside the city gates, he is starting to prepare a ceremony where everyone will bow down before Paul and Barnabas, that they realize what's going on. We can, of course, understand why people are, why they do it, because they have seen the miracle with their own eyes. They knew this man. He's been living in the city for decades, and they see this instant miracle. According to a number of commentaries, there is also a historical background that may explain why they are so enthusiastic to bow down and worship the apostles. So there was a story told about this region that the gods once come to visit this area, disguised as a poor human beings. They search for food and shelter, and no one opened the doors or their hearts for them. So they were rejected. The Hispanic gods were rejected until they came to a very old couple, Philemon and Baucis, who opened their house for them. And as a punishment, the area was destroyed in a natural catastrophe. So they have this background of our forefathers rejected the gods when they came to us, and they were punished for it. And now they can obviously see that God is acting here, healing the man. So of course they do not want to redo the mistake of the forefathers. So now they really want to honor Paul and Barnabas. It's a very interesting thing to try to imagine this, the situation when the apostles realize this. Wow, the whole city is going to worship us. They think that Barnabas is Zeus, the highest god, and that Paul is Hermes. And there's an explanation why they identified Paul as Hermes, because he was the one speaking. And Hermes was, from his name we have the word hermeneutics, he was the one who explained the will of the gods. So they thought Barnabas is Zeus, the highest god, standing more behind, more silent, and then he has this messenger, Hermes, that's Paul. Do you ever entertain the thought that the apostles were not honest men? This is an interesting text. If they were preaching the gospel for selfish reasons, now they have a chance. The whole city thinks they are divine, and they want to worship them. Suddenly the door is open for money and power and influence and women and sex, whatever you can imagine. They think Barnabas is Zeus and Paul is Hermes. So if they want to take advantage of the gospel preaching, this is the time. So it's really exciting to see what is the reaction of the apostles. Do they make use of this? It must have been a kind of temptation. People want to elevate you to a divine status. And the priest is arranging a ceremony of worship for your honor. I don't think we should minimize the power of that kind of temptation. And a lot of people starting to look at you from this perspective. Now, of course, the apostles, they did not make any use for their own gain in this situation. When they understood the situation, they tore their clothes, which is, of course, an action which is totally meaningless for us. Why destroy some clothing? It does not bear any significance for us. But that is an act, a public act, which communicates very strongly in that context. It's like in our culture when people want to show really dismiss you or show contempt, people give you the finger. They do something with your body which has strong connotations, and you can read it, you understand it. There was a lot of questions in the Western world when President Bush was in Iraq and someone threw a shoe at him. What's the meaning of throwing a shoe? It has no significance for us at all. But in many cultures, the shoe is a symbol of uncleanness because the shoe is tramping on dirt. So throwing a shoe at someone is showing contempt for that person. In Jewish culture, to tore your clothing was a way of publicly expressing how upset you were, like the high priest tearing his clothes when Jesus said, "I am." And you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven and so on. So Paul immediately shows publicly how upset he is by their identification of him as a god and their wanting to worship him. And so he rushes into the crowd, and here is his speech. It's not a very, very well prepared speech. He had no time to make any PowerPoints, but he just had to rush into the crowd and speak to them. And so I continue to read. "Friends, why are you doing this? We too are only human, like you. We are bringing you good news, telling you to turn from these worthless things to the living God, who made the heavens and the earth and the sea and everything in them. In the past, he let all nations go their own way, yet he has not left himself without testimony. He has shown kindness by giving you rain from heaven and crops in their seasons. He provides you with plenty of food and fills your heart with joy. Even with these words, they had difficulty keeping the crowd from sacrificing to them." And then later on, the crowd are joined by some hostile people from Thessalonica, and they stone Paul. So there is a lot of hostility. But let's make some comments about this short speech from Paul. Of course, we need to be careful. It's a very short speech, not to do too much out of it. But I think it's reasonable to read this short speech in the light of the much longer speech to the Gentiles that Paul is given in Athens. And we can see there are many similarities in the thoughts. So I think we have an interpretive tool in Acts 17 to understand what is the meaning of this short book. First, notice the attitude of Paul. They want to worship him and Barnabas as gods. And he chooses a total identification with this group of Gentile people. He's really strong. "What are you doing? We are only human. We are only men, human like you." So he's not taking advantage at all of their identification of him as God. He's not even saying something about his Jewish heritage or his position as an apostle of Christ. He is totally identifying himself with them. As a created human being, we are all on the same level. And he's really keen on saying that. I think this is a powerful statement, or showing his attitude. "I am like him. We are humans together." And it's totally crazy to try to elevate someone who is only a human to something else than a human. Secondly, he seems to indirectly affirm insights they have. Their perspective is that Paul is Hermes, the god who can interpret the divine messages. Now that's a total misunderstanding. Paul is not at all divine. But there is a grain of truth. He is a kind of Hermes figure. So that's his next step. "I am bringing you good news." You're not 100% off track when you say, "I am Hermes." Of course, it's totally wrong in terms of my ontology, I'm not divine, but in terms of what I'm here to do, you have found something. I am here to bring you the good news. So he's identifying something within this really wrong picture which he can say yes to, which he can affirm. I think we as evangelists should really try hard to find everything that is possible to affirm in a secular culture or within the life of a person we are talking to. Not only find the contrast and the differences and the distance, but also be able to affirm what we have in common. We're human beings together. There's no distinction there. And in the beliefs and worldviews and life of the person we're talking with, there will be things which we can affirm and say yes to and embrace and say, yeah, we are on the same line here. But this is not relativistic or just wishy-washy Paul here. He can affirm what is true within his hearers, but he's also really brave. Again, if you have a fantasy with you, if you imagine all the people, and then you have the priest from the temple just outside the walls, and in that means Paul, he is really courageous. I'm telling you to turn from these worthless things, these worthless gods. They have no reality. So he's also really outspoken and honest and clear. It takes some guts to tell a group of people who a few minutes ago wanted to worship you that here you're totally wrong. And this is actually worthless. So Paul is also challenging. I think this is describes very nicely the kind of attitude we should develop. And I sometimes say, I do really like to see a lot of Lystra churches being started in Sweden. Churches where people identify with secular Swedes can affirm what is good and right, and at the same time don't lose the edge of the gospel and the call of repentance and the truth issue. That there is a real God and we are worshipping idols. Paul is not just stating that Susan Herbis and all things related to them are just worthless, and they are worthless gods. He gives, I think, three arguments for why they should turn to the living God. So the contrast is between those worthless gods and the living God. And then Paul is actually, at least in an indirect way, arguing for the truth of the God he directs them to. And I would say that there are at least the seeds of three arguments in his small speech here. So, he says, you should turn to the living God. And then there he describes who the living God is by saying, the living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and everything in them. You need really to turn to your attention to the ultimate reality, to the ultimate cause of the universe. You should not turn your attention to gods who are different aspects of the universe. You need to go beyond that. What is the ultimate explanation of everything that exists? You see how Paul is just adding the God who made heaven and earth and sea and everything. What is the explanation of everything that exists? Now, it's not Zeus. He is part of reality. It's not Hermes. They are small, limited, finite gods who need an explanation themselves. You need to go beyond that and find the ultimate reference point for everything that exists. And that is the living God, the God of Israel, who has created everything. And in a secular culture, this is what I think we constantly need to do, to ask people, what is the ultimate explanation of everything? So we have a lot of naturalists and materialists around us, they would have as their ultimate explanation the particle, the energy particle. But that cannot explain itself. They must found the ultimate explanation of everything. You need to go beyond that to understand the universe we are a part of. Secondly, and that's the main part of his short speech, Paul talks about us as human beings and talks about this God who has created everything is the God that sustains our lives. He provides us with all the good things. He gives us rain from heaven and fruitful season, and you're filling our hearts with joy. Of course, as a Swede, I'm not always thankful for the rain, but we need to think that this is the Mediterranean, and rain is, of course, a really strong symbol and picture of life, because after rain you have harvest, and then you and your family and your culture have life. So that's, of course, the meaning of that. So God is the one who provides us with our lives and fills our heart with joy. Often in evangelism, we identify all the tragic aspects of human existence. And that's a good thing to do. We need to do it, all the consequences of the fall. So we point out the misery, the loneliness, the guilt, death, the hopelessness of our human predicament. And we show that Jesus Christ is the only solution for the negative sides of life. And I totally agree. It's a good evangelistic presentation. So we should do that. But we can also do the opposite, to identify all the best things in human life and say, this one source God. The only real explanation for this is God. And this is what Paul is doing here. He's pointing them towards their finest moments when their hearts were filled with joy. And he seems to say, in that moment, you received a signal from the living God. That was a signal from God into your life, calling you towards Him. And here I think we need to develop an apologetic where we can help people to see this connection between the highest moment of their lives and the bad in the beauty of really good music, in the power of love, in the when we experience nature in its power and beauty and majesty, there is a signal from God. Even secular Swedes, when they're climbing up in the mountains in the north, and after a number of hours, and if it's a clear day, you finally come up on the top, and you can see for miles. And you're standing there, and your heart is... Secular Swedes become religious. The experience is so powerful. And in that moment, very few people say, oh, there's a God. It's just fantastic. Or the sunrise in the archipelago. Wow. It's powerful. It grips your heart. The problem is that there are several hours then walking down the mountain, and no, it's not God. It was, yes, it's had work, but it's the other thing. I remember especially a friend at the University of Lund. When I was studying there, he was a few years older than I. He was a very secular, atheistic person. He and his girlfriend had a baby. And the experience for him of being part of the birth and becoming a father, it's atheistic world was shattered. And he told me that I look religious, but when I come home from the hospital that night, I had the lit candle. And I just sat in silence in my kitchen. And I became almost religious. So there was, before, he was drawn towards God through the miracle of receiving his own baby. And I think it's here in the text. Paul is pointing them towards the highest moments of human existence, saying, that's a symbol of God. The living God has created everything, but he's also concerned about you and your joy. And when you feel this deep joy, not just a laugh at the moment, but this deep joy, that is from God. And you should turn to him. He's the source of that. And thirdly, there is an allusion, even though if it's weak, but there is an allusion to history. Paul is not really fulfilling his own thought, but he directs them to history, saying, in the past, God let all nations go their own way. And then we know from other preaching of Paul how he continues that sentence. But now, in Jesus Christ, he has finally intervened, and we're moving into the final stage of human history. And that's proved by the resurrection. So he is starting to talk about history, but Luke is not giving us any details if he said more or what's happening. But he has a reference to God's interaction in history and how God has let all people go their own way. But as an apostle of Christ, he now knows that God has intervened in a unique way. So he is pointing them to history. So he's really giving a kind of big picture, that is, isn't it? He is presenting his face from a really big picture. The universe, where does it come from? Human being, who are you? How to understand, in this case, the best side of our existence. And then history. Where is God in human history? What's going on in this long sequence of individuals and nations on planet Earth? Where is God in this? So it's a big picture. If there are comments or questions, or if you want to keep the question, how can we help people to understand that? How to connect, help people to connect their experience to our message. And I think one thing is to help people to put words on what they've experienced. Because what's going on in our culture is that people do those experiences, but they have not a framework for interpreting it. And think of music, which is such a big thing in our culture. And you think of a modern concert. It's a really good concert. At the end of it, it's almost like worship situation. I was recently at a concert in Stockholm since I have some Brits there, with Paul McCartney. And of course, it was a lot of middle-aged people like me wanting to see their youth hero. If you're a Beatles fan, which I happen to be, it was a great concert. And there were moments in the concert where the atmosphere and the feeling in this huge arena, it was amazing. And you can see it, how people were gripped by the beauty of the music and of this whole situation. Afterwards, very few Swedes would be able to put into words what did I experience and why and how to interpret it and why is this affecting me so deeply? What is music in the universe where there is no God? And why is it so powerful? Or to move to another area, to make a comment that I first heard Timothy Keller making, which I thought was very, very interesting. And that's related to our experience of nature. And he said, Why is it that nature causes the same feeling in us as art does? Why do we have similar feelings in front of nature as we have when we are experience art? And we see the connection. Maybe nature is a work of art. I think that's a powerful that's a powerful argument. Because it is very similar. The deep emotion you feel when you see nature in its beauty and the experience you have at a Beethoven piano concert. There is similarities in how it affects you. Why is that? Can there be an artist behind nature? Like there is an artist between the music. So I think we should throw in questions and possible ways of interpreting this. The question is that some people would say that religion has kept people and nations in bondage, and the way to have freedom is to get rid of religion. Nations were not free, like Paul said here, to go their own way in the past, because they were bound by their religions. I think that's a slightly confusing two different discussions. What Paul is saying here is that God obviously did not intervene in every nation and culture and punishing evil, for example, or showing fully who he is, but he let history after the fall pass its run, and but he started to intervene in Israel, and finally he intervened in, through Jesus Christ. And we know there were times when he intervened in punishment, but the general, if you look at the general picture of humanity, which is Paul's point here, in the past God let nations go their own way, but now something has happened. Now the atheist argument that so much of religion have people and nations in bondage and they need to be liberated, I can say amen to most of that. You know, I'm not a defender of religion in general. I'm a defender of religious freedom, the freedom for everyone to choose their own religion or leave their religion and so on. But I agree with much of the new atheists' criticism of religion. You know, you think of Hinduism, the law of karma. It's just horrible. It's just horrible. And you can think of so many religious systems that have people in bondage. So we are not defenders of all different religions, but we think there is one religion which is actually true and liberating. And that is the Christian faith, that is God of the Bible. And so when we can affirm what the new atheists are saying, we should. But then they have also a lot of very naive points in relation to religion. That we are so special compared to everything else on this earth. So we can see that the dog is not amazed over there, the sun rising. And we can also see I sometimes take another example. If you look deeply into the eyes of a cow, have a try. Of course, I don't know what's going on in the head of a cow, but my feeling at that moment is that the cow is not really worried over her existence, whether I come from, where I'm going. Who am I? What about my guilt? Nothing of that. As long as there is no immediate threat to her existence, she just exists. But we as human beings, if we look into our eyes, we know that just below the surface, all those questions are there all the time. So that's another way of identifying the same difference. Are there any other authors than Lewis who can help us in identifying the goodness of life connected to unbelief in God? Lewis is the obvious example here. He's just marvelous in doing that. I think we can make some use of some non-Christian writers who put words to this. And I could think of some Swedish, because in terms of, if it's not theological literature or philosophical literature, I read Swedish. So I can think of some Swedish poets or authors that I would use that have put words that resonate very well within Swedish culture, and then try to make use of that. I would also say an area, it can be touchy for us as Christians to talk about it, because often we want to draw a line when we talk about sexuality. Our own culture is going so wrong in all the things sexual. But I think we just have to realize that even if people live far outside God's will when it comes to sexuality, sexuality is a precious gift from God, and even when people use sexuality outside what God has for, there is still, sex is still, for many people, an aspect of life which is a strong signal from God. And I wouldn't be afraid of using that. Many non-Christians have experiences which approaches the transcendental in relationship to sex. And as Christians, I understand why. The man-woman relationship in marriage is meant to be an illustration of Christ and the church, so that there will be signals within sex in the direction of God. It's not surprising. So that would actually be another, but it's a little bit touchy how you do it. And you also need to be aware that many people have very bad experiences of sex, of the tool people use to manipulate you or hurt you. So it's touchy. You need to think through how you use it. But I think it is an area where this is really, can be really powerful also. Okay, let's then move on to Athens. And it's a much longer text, and we will not be able to go into it in all its details. And there are many good commentators about the text, and I'm sure you have heard many presentations on Acts 17. I think that's only a positive, a good thing. I think it is a text that we should constantly wrestle with and be inspired by and challenged by. So Paul comes down to Athens. He is there by himself. His co-workers are still left in Thessalonica and in Beroia, trying to help the Christians there. Paul is very courageous. He speaks in the synagogue. He speaks on out in the public, on the square, every day with all the people who were there. He comes in contact with philosophers, both Epicureans and Stoics. And he causes some stir there. Some people are just dismisses him as kind of he's like a falsy thinker. Not taking him seriously, they think he's just not a real thinker. Other people misunderstand him, thinking that he's preaching two different gods, Jesus and Anastasis, Jesus and the resurrection. So they are really stuck in a in a polytheistic framework, thinking of different gods and this reality, different aspects of this reality, there is a God connection to that. So if there's resurrection, there must be a God of resurrection. So they think he preaches Jesus and Anastasis. And then some people starting to understand something and wanting Paul to really have a chance to explain himself. And they bring him to the Areopagos, which was a council in Athens. And Paul had a chance to give a more formal presentation. Had this long and very well-known presentation from Paul. So if we go to Acts 17, from and we go directly to his talk. So that's from verse 22. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you're ignorant of the very thing you worship. And this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. For one man he made all the nations, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him. There is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. And some of your own poets have said, 'We are his offspring.' Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, 'We want to hear you again on the subject.' At that, Paul left the council. Some of the people became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others." This is a much longer speech, and I think we can assume it's much more well prepared, because I don't think they went from the open square immediately, just walked to the Areopagus and had a meeting. I guess that had to be arranged, and there needed to be an appointed time. So Paul had at least a number of hours. I would guess a number of days, but it was not an instant, spontaneous speech, I think. And when we look at this speech, we can see the same thing, that Paul is giving this big picture presentation of the gospel. So it's the two speeches in Lystra and Athens are really coherent with each other. We can see that Paul has the same kind of attitude, trying to affirm as much as he can before he challenges. So in the speech, Paul moves from contact to contrast to conflict. He starts very insightful by identifying an author. An altar which he can use very creatively. It is an ambiguous situation where he can draw out both positive and negative things. So he makes that his starting point, and it's a rich starting point from where he can move in several different directions. So I've seen you are very religious. I see you also have an altar to the unknown God. And I affirm that. And then he can start to also make some criticism. Yeah, it's really true, you don't know the real God. And I am coming to you with a message about this God, whom you already acknowledge, and you have already an altar to him. So you are on to something, but at the same time, you don't know him. But he has made you know, himself known, and I can now share this with you. And then, in the end of this talk, he again is really, really courageous by challenging everyone, everywhere, to repent. So it's a strong, it's a very clear move from contact, and then we start to contrast things, and then there will be a real point of tension, of conflict, where he is challenging everyone to repent. It's the same when he then goes on to talk about God, that he affirms and challenges his hearers at the same time. Now he has a very difficult situation. He has three groups of people in front of him. He has polytheists with their conception of the gods of the world. He has Epicureans with their conception, and they basically believe that the God has left the world. They were not here any longer, so there was no connection any longer between the gods and the world. The world was given over to itself. In practical terms, they were atheists. Philosophically, they were theists. And then he had the Stoics. They were pantheists. They were merging God and the world into one. So Paul had to go into this discussion. What is the relationship between God and the world? Is it a polytheistic understanding? Is it an Epicurean understanding? Is it a Stoic understanding? And he has to present the true understanding, which is neither of those. But he could affirm things in most of the perspectives, but then have to criticize some other aspects. So he affirms the Epicureans are right. God is not to identify. He's separate. He's the creator. But on the other hand, we need to criticize the Epicureans. God has not left the world. So it's right. There's a close relationship. It is in him we live and have our being. So he moves back and forth between affirming and criticizing. And if you study what he's saying about transcendence and immanence here, you will see Paul is just a genius as a communicator in dealing with this really difficult audience. He reasoned with his audience. So, now if God is like this, then we cannot think like this about God. Now God is like this, therefore. So he's really using arguments, helping people to think. Now if this is true, then you cannot say this. No, you need to say this. What follows from this is this. There's a strong logical component in his speech. And then he really, really challenges. So it's something to be challenged by, I think, to move from contact to contrast and to establish also a point of conflict or challenge. Or, sorry.
Thank you.
And secondly here, we can see that Paul focused on three major themes. Again, we have the big picture. So if you analyze his speech, he goes from, who is God? and really painting the picture of the biblical God, who is a transcendent God, the creator of everything, but he's imminent. He's close to all of us. And yet we are separated from him. We are here to search him and have connection with him. Something goes wrong. He talks about man, yeah, that's the second point. He talks about our place in history, that we are created by God. The meaning of our whole existence is to know our Creator. And God has not abandoned his creation. But there is a problem with our relationship with God. We are called to search for him. And then Paul uses a word which means a blind person trying to find a way but not really reaching the goal. So he is explaining the human situation, and in this speech he is more focusing on the problem we have. And lastly, he focuses in on history, and here he makes it really clear. God has now intervened in history. We are moving towards a point where God will judge everyone, and the judge is already appointed, that is Jesus. So, and then he brings in the gospel message that we can know who the judge is because God has given public proof of it by raising Jesus from the dead. So it has the same direction. God and his relationship to the world, man and our relationship to God, and history, what God has done, ultimately in Jesus Christ. And that gives him the chance to explain